Hello and welcome to another Glenbrook podcast. My name is Shannon Conway and today I'll be talking to Councillor Suzanne Richards, the Executive Member for Housing and Regeneration at Manchester City Council. This week marks the third anniversary of the horrific fire at Grenfell Tower, which claimed 72 lives and injured many, many more. We'll be discussing Suzanne's journey to her current role, the events at Grenfell and how they still affect the lives of thousands of residents in Manchester, and the welcome but challenging issues surrounding the £1 billion Building Safety Fund recently launched by the government. For context, the conversation was recorded over Zoom during COVID-19.
Good afternoon, Suzanne. It's really good to have you here. Where are you today?
I'm at home, like probably a lot of other people at the moment. Been working from home since the start of lockdown. I'm able to do my councillor role mainly from here. I've been kind of out and about a couple of times for work, but obviously with appropriate social distancing measures in place.
It's all a little bit of a change, isn't it? Any hope of getting back to the office anytime soon?
I was thinking, because our floor is very, it's a big floor in the town hall and actually we're quite spaced out, we're not close together. So I was thinking of maybe starting to pop back in one day a week for a change of scenery more than anything. I've been dusting the bike off in readiness, so.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I had the bike out last weekend and planning my route into the city centre. So yeah. I might join you on the commute.
Yeah, although I do have the challenges of the A6 to face. So I'm not the most confident of cyclists, but we'll see.
In it together.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to join us this morning. Just to introduce yourself, you're a Labour councillor and you represent the Longsight ward and you're also executive member for Housing and Regeneration. I'm always intrigued to find out how people get into politics. So would you be able to tell us a little bit about your background and then in particular your role in housing and regeneration?
Yeah, sure. I think probably like a lot of people, I didn't kind of deliberately choose to get involved in politics. It kind of involved me. When I went through university, did history, politics and philosophy. And my life plan was that I was going to go out, work for a bit, probably do some work in and around politics. But then go and get my qualifications and become a history and politics teacher was what I wanted to do initially. But as soon as I started working in politics, I got hooked. I started off working for a member of the European Parliament and then worked on a regional campaign in the Northwest for the Labour Party here. And then actually went out to Brussels to work for a member of the European Parliament there. Mm-hmm. And eventually came back and settled in Manchester. And it was really once I settled in Manchester that I made that switch from, I suppose, working in politics behind the scenes, doing all the support for politicians, to thinking actually I'd really like to be able to do some of these things myself. And I've always had an active interest and involvement in community organising, so ensuring that people are able to build power at a very local level and change things for themselves. Mm-hmm. And becoming a local councillor and all the good things that Manchester City Council were doing and are still doing just made me want to be kind of, I suppose, more involved and on the front line of that.
Mm-hmm. So when did you come back from Brussels? How long ago was that?
It was a good while ago. So it was 2000 and when would it have been? 2011? No, it can't have been that late. 2001. I knew there was a one in there somewhere. Once you get past 40, like it's just kind of blur over the years.
It's when you start getting CVs with dates of birth on in the 2000s.
Yeah, it was 2001, sort of late in the year in 2001 when I came back.
Great. And then your role in housing and regeneration, how did that come about?
Really, my interest in housing and involvement in housing started more directly when I became a councillor. As a councillor, one of your biggest inquiries that you get kind of through your email inbox and at your advice sessions is about housing, people's housing conditions, their need for housing. I think that kind of got me interested in the politics of it. But then I became a member of what was then Eastlands Housing, which later merged with City South and created One Manchester Housing Association. And I've been on their board now for 7 years. I think I've come up to 7 years. So I've kind of learned a lot by being on that board about housing and the challenges of building affordable housing at the moment. And when the vacancy for the exec member position for housing came up, I decided that I wanted to throw my hat in the ring. We have a competitive process in Manchester in our Labour group, so you go up against your other colleagues, and we have a hustings, and then the Labour group chooses who the exec member will be.
It's interesting you say that, because it just illustrates how important the home to everybody, to individuals, it's shelter, it's security, and the quality of that needs to be of a certain level. And if it's not, it affects your whole life. And I suppose that's what we're going to be talking about here.
Yeah.
So much to talk about, but the focus of today is the issue of unsafe cladding, and particularly how it affects people's lives. And it's now 3 years on from the terrible events at Grenfell Tower. And for a lot of people, for those 3 years, we talk about it as being unimaginable, but for a lot of people throughout the UK, it's not unimaginable, because they're imagining it every single day and every single night. And you know, your home is supposed to be a sanctuary, isn't it? And somewhere where you can find peace. And when it's not, the effects of that on your mental health, but also on other aspects of your life, which we'll talk about, can be quite devastating.
They can, yeah. And I think, you know, I think what has, I suppose, surprised me most, I mean, I when Grenfell happened, I was actually on holiday at the time. I'd just finished some medical treatment and was having a break, and kind of watched everything unfold in horror throughout that evening and the following day. And then when I came back, and you know, we started having conversations at a board level about potential high rise within One Manchester's housing stock and work that was going to have to take place to change the cladding on that, I suddenly started to realise the kind of scale of the challenge. But I think really even then, because social landlords, majority of them, were able to respond quite quickly, and the government provided clarity relatively early on around funding for them, resolutions progressed, and you know, we now have no social housing blocks in Manchester that have ACM cladding. But then when I became the executive member in 2018, it was probably within a couple of weeks that the residents from the Green Quarter got in touch with me, and I suddenly then started to realise the scale outside of social housing in terms of the private sector, people who are leaseholders on have bought their apartments, and the challenges that they were facing in order to be able to, first of all, have the remediation take place and their buildings be made safe. But beyond that, that they, you know, that the costs were being entirely put on to leaseholders. And there was no, at that time, they didn't seem to be any discussion within the industry and with government about supporting leaseholders at all.
Yeah. So to any listeners that may be unclear, in the social housing sector, you don't tend to have these problems because the housing association will own the freehold of the building, so can tackle the issues directly. Whereas in the private sector, you've got long leaseholders, and the person who built the building would have been building in line with the regulations at that time, so would say, well, that's not our issue. I suppose the freeholder of the building would say, well, you know, it's, we can manage the process and we can look to get Waking Watch and we can look to getting a contractor to make the replacements, but you are the long leaseholders, you're going to have to pay. And then you've got the long leaseholders there at the bottom of the chain, sort of holding their hands up and in desperation.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what struck me when I had that first meeting with, I think it was three residents from the Green Quarter, was these were young people, predominantly young professionals, who it was their first home. So they hadn't built up equity in their home and they were either on the verge with the bills of facing bankruptcy or facing having to take out huge loans. And also because they couldn't remortgage or sell their property either because of the cladding on the building, and they were actually locked there. You know, they had no option but to remain in those apartments. And many of them had actually bought the apartments under Help to Buy. So they didn't even have, you know, they kind of had low deposits. Mm-hmm. So from an equity perspective, they just didn't have any fallback. And it felt, you could see it was very frightening for them and stressful. And I think that was really that first meeting with the residents from the Green Quarter was when the kind of real human impact of it started to me to kind of understand that really in terms of the private buildings.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the scale of the problem. Are there a number of buildings that, you know, are at risk?
In Manchester, we had 12 buildings that still have ACM and require some form of remedial works. All of those that have ACM though now have a plan in place, and so they are in the process of remediation. Mm-hmm. But then we also have a further 50 buildings that are on Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Services database, which have what are called interim measures in place. So that means that they have some identified defect that requires remediation, and therefore they've either had to have a Waking Watch mm-hmm. or some other interim measure to ensure the residents' safety within that building.
And the Waking Watch isn't cheap, is it?
It's not, no, and predominantly that cost is being passed on to leaseholders. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the fund that government have announced last week won't cover any of those interim measures either, although the funding itself is a challenge.
We'll come on to that later. We've got a lot of people who are, as you mentioned, living in these buildings, a lot of young people. I imagine there's other groups in the city centre as well. I know a lot of downsized empty nesters who probably moved in and didn't expect these costs. I imagine it's difficult for them as well. And especially during this time where we are in lockdown, can't be a pleasant experience.
No, not at all. And I've spoken to lots of residents in very different situations, and some of them really suffering with their mental health as a result of the situation they found themselves in. Who have said they've never had issues with their mental health previously. And one of the things that the Manchester Gladiators group that was established by some of the residents that were involved in the Green Quarter campaign, one of the things that they have been doing is supporting residents with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. it's hard to fathom really when you're not in that situation how it must feel living in a building that is not safe and needs remediation.
I followed the Cladiators on Twitter, and you get the sense of a feeling of community that's been created by that group, and camaraderie and everyone being there to support one another. You really get a sense of it.
Yeah, it is. And I've watched kind of friendships get established between members of that group. And I think that's, you know, I'm always an optimist, and I always like to look on the positive side of things. And I think that is one of the things that has come out of this. And I hope, you know, that a lot of those blocks are able to kind of maintain that, I suppose, that kind of closeness and communication between residents going forward, because it's often quite hard in high rise, and particularly in a city centre, to establish those relationships and sense of community. But the Cladiators have done that really well.
Do you think there's anything the private sector could have done differently?
I think for me, the challenge has always been that the way that government has approached remediation and not sought to bring players around the table at a national level. You know, that was how we managed to get a resolution to the Green Quarter, was by one of our senior officers within the council helping to kind of broker those conversations and bringing people together with residents, the previous developer and owner of the building and the current owner of the building. And then it also involved discussions with the insurers as well. But there's been, I haven't seen any evidence, you know, the government came forward with the ACM cladding fund. But again, that didn't put any onus or pressure on the sector to respond and do their bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge when you look at the additional fund that the government's come forward with now. And, you know, I'm not going to be overly critical of the government in that sense, because, you know, they have put financial resource into this. You know, I think it's 1.6 billion they will have put forward with the ACM cladding fund and this new fund. But the new fund that they're proposing will only cover what we think around of the third of the costs that it's going to take now to remediate buildings.
That's nationally, the scale of the problem nationally, it's just a third of the cost. And it's also for buildings over 80 metres, isn't it?
Next
worry is for buildings below that height.
Yeah, and the challenge is those that have been excluded from the 1 billion pot. One case we have in Manchester is Skyline Central 1, who actually went, so because they wanted to progress the works on their building, and they weren't, you know, they took out loans under the impression that they would be able to then apply for the Building Safety Fund. And government have basically said that they aren't eligible to apply, which feels very unjust, really.
It does. They've gone out of their way to get things moving, and, you know, I imagine a lot of work's gone into that. To hear that they're not able to claim must be a real kick in the teeth.
Yeah, I think they feel that they're being penalised for having, acted in a way that they felt was responsible in terms of ensuring that their building could be remediated.
Green Quarter, I assume the residents made financial contributions there, did they?
They didn't in the end. Actually, the in the Green Quarter, the deal that was agreed between the various interested parties covered all the costs of the work, and actually it covered their interim measures as well.
Fantastic. And was Manchester part of that?
We were a broker, I suppose, how you would describe it. But it was very intense. It went on for a number of months. It was two steps forward, five steps back throughout the entire process. I've often described it as like a game of three-dimensional chess. because you have got a number of interested parties who are not going to move without commitments from the others. Mm-hmm. But we got there in the end, but that amount of time and resource,
it's a full-time
you couldn't job. Multiply that over the, you know, the 50 blocks that have interim measures at the moment in Manchester. It's just not practical at any level, which is why I do feel that government needs to be doing more to broker that conversation at a national level and get the players around the table and say, right, we've put, and you know, they've put that 1.6 billion so far into this. What is the industry's input? And that's from, you know, construction and development, but also some of these building management and companies and the insurance sector as well. You know, what when we look at some of the buildings and what's happened in Manchester, as residents and buildings have had work assessed, they've discovered things that actually originally on the building should have been done in a different way. Things like compartmentalisation, which hasn't been done properly, and actually that is a liability of who originally built that building. But unfortunately, for those buildings that fall outside of the 10-year period, they're not, they can't claim on insurance, and often because of the way the sector is, companies may have either gone into administration, gone completely, or have gone through so many different metamorphoses since that they, you know, that you can no longer hold them liable in a direct way.
It's a very complex issue, isn't it? I think from the industry would say, I suppose on the argument of the cladding, if it was legally approved, then, you know, that's not our fault. But the issue on, can never say the word, compartmentalisation and the things that should have been done, then yes, definitely there's grounds there, isn't there, to say, well, why should the residents pick up the tag for that?
Absolutely. You know, and I think had there been a sense early on that government was going to hold the different parts of the industry to account and get them to contribute, I think, you know, that there would have also been a willingness around leaseholders as well of making some form of contribution if it was works that, you know, were not previously required of buildings, you know, the things that have come out as a in terms of changes in regulations. But actually at the moment, from a fairness point of view, the entire costs are being thrown onto leaseholders, which can't ever be viewed as fair by anybody, I would say.
We know this 1.6 billion is not going to cover the repairs, or it's specifically to remove unsafe cladding, isn't it? As you say, there could be other issues that come up, but there are some caveats, aren't there? You mentioned before you can't, if you've already applied, you can't, like the guys at Skyline, they can't apply for it. Are there other people that are excluded from this?
Well, basically anybody who has already commissioned any works prior to the 11th of March is excluded, but then it doesn't cover all the works that may need to take place. Mm. So for buildings that have some form of cladding, they will, you know, they are likely to be able to apply. But for example, if you have discovered on your building that have no cladding, but you've got compartmentalisation issues, which are pretty major issues, and one of the things that came out of Grenfell in terms of things that needed to be addressed, then that's not covered, or they can't apply for the fund at the moment. So we're in the process. GM leaders will be writing to government to set out some of the challenges with the fund at the moment and make that case to government. We've also been having meetings with the shadow ministerial team. We've also had a meeting with the new minister, Lord Greenhalgh, and have been making these points around the fund to them.
Is there a race to the fund in a way? I'm imagining if you know there's not enough money there for everybody, are we saying to sort of local residents, you know, get your application set up as quickly as you can, you know, we can give you support in that to get in early doors, as it were?
I suppose for buildings that are applying, they can only apply at a given pace. Because it's about the stage at which they're at in terms of having their building checked and assessed in the proper way and actually knowing the works that need to take place. And that's another thing regarding the fund, is that actually that there's a requirement that they tender before December 2020. Well, actually, if you think about all the challenges at the moment with lockdown and that the sector is facing, are buildings going to be in a position to tender all of them before December 2020? I don't think that's the case.
It's interesting, when the additional £1 billion was announced, I think a lot of people thought, that's it, it's all sorted now, you know, the lights are coming in the tunnel. But talking to you today, it certainly isn't. It's a step forward, isn't it? But it's certainly not, you know, you can see that light at the end of the tunnel.
No, and you know, I don't want to be overly critical of government, because I do think they have acted in terms of putting the hands in the pockets. But actually, for example, one issue that we have raised consistently with them around VAT. So most of these works are liable for VAT. That's an additional 20% cost. Mm. We've asked MHCLG to raise it with Treasury. Sir Richard wrote to the Secretary of State, and there's just been no movement on it. And if you think of 20% of the costs when you're looking at a £3 billion total, that's a huge amount and significant amount of money.
Yeah, so you'll continue to lobby, it sounds like, to government and just make sure that all these questions have been raised and they're being challenged.
We have the GM high-rise task force that the Mayor of Salford chairs, and we work together collaboratively across Greater Manchester. We'll continue to work with Manchester Gladiators. And when I started my role as exec member for housing, I never thought that cladding would be and fire safety would be in my top three priorities, and it's very firmly there and is going to be remaining there until this is resolved for residents, because ultimately to me it's about fairness and about, I suppose, what we started talking about at the beginning was the importance of home and having a safe and secure home. It's quite fundamental, really, and it's one of our priorities as a city council, is that people in our city should have access to a safe, secure and affordable home. And while you have big issues like this at play in the city, then we're not meeting that requirement, so it's our duty to work with residents until it's resolved.
And if people are interested in following the discussion, or there's residents in buildings and they're concerned, where would you recommend people go, or who should they be following?
Well, there's a number of groups online, so that we've been talking about the Manchester Gladiators, but there's groups all over the UK now. There's UK Cladding Action, there's also the National Leaseholders Group, who do a lot of work coordinating the different cladding groups. And who else? Oh, I would say in terms of reading up and being up to date, Inside Housing do a lot on the cladding issue. They've been involved in leading the campaign which led to the establishment of the first ACM fund. So there's a number of their writers who should definitely, you should follow.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it'll stay at the forefront of people's minds, and one positive that's come out of it is there is so much emphasis now on fire safety in buildings and having people there throughout the development process checking that things are being done properly, sort of inside and out. So hopefully we'll never see another Grenfell again.
Yes.
So. Well, finally, my last interviewee told me the song that would form part of the soundtrack to her life. So continuing in sort of Desert Island disc style. Oh, such a good question. I'm going to steal it from her and I'm going to ask everyone the same. So which song would you choose and why?
I suppose for me, it would be a song by Doreen called Things Can Only Get Better. It was what that I think it relates a lot to our conversation today. So it was the soundtrack to the Labour Party during the 97 general election, which really kind of solidified my interest and involvement in politics. But I think it's an optimistic and hopeful song. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's quite challenging times at the moment in lots of different ways, not just with COVID-19, but, you know, the issue we've been talking about today, but also more broadly in terms of everything that's going on at the moment around the United States and the Black Lives Matter campaign. So I think Things Can Only Get Better is a positive and optimistic soundtrack.
And very apt. And local lad, Professor Brian Cox on keyboard, no less.
Exactly.
That's a good choice. Well, thanks very much for taking the time today, Suzanne. Lots to think about and just really important to keep on pushing this issue and thinking about those people who are still, you know, suffering from the effects of Grenfell 3 years on. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's good to talk to you.